the southern Iranian city of Bandar Abbas witnesses a ceremony welcoming Navy's 86th flotilla back home after a mission around the world. Meanwhile, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces tells Press TV that the flotilla accomplished its mission despite U.S. threats and pressures. And people in Greece head to the polls in a general election overshadowed by a cost of living crisis and a train disaster in February. Thanks for joining us. An official ceremony has been held in the southern Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of a naval flotilla back home after a successful journey around the world. The ceremony was attended by top military commanders, including the Chief of General Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces. Major General Mohammad Baghari said at the ceremony that the expedition marks the beginning of a new chapter in the growth of Iran's naval power. The general added that the mission is a unique achievement for a navy that's been subject to sanctions and other propaganda and pressure. The flotilla comprised the domestically manufactured Dena destroyer and Makran forward-based ship. They entered Iranian waters on May 17. The flotilla completed a 63,000-kilometer journey around the Earth in 8 months. Marked the first time that an Iranian naval group entered the Pacific. The vessel sailed to South America and visited South Africa before returning home. A correspondent, Gisumish Ahmadi, asked the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghari, about the U.S. pressure campaign against the flotilla. This is what he had to say.
Tell us about the U.S. The U.S. had threatened countries, had asked countries not to allow the Iranian flotilla, the Iranian warships, to dock in their countries. However, we saw that despite U.S. threats, countries like Brazil did not heed the U.S. threats, and also some sanctions had been imposed on this flotilla. The eight-month voyage by this flotilla around the world showed that we can, with reliance on our own capabilities, we can be present in any place in the world, in the oceans around the world, wherever the maritime law allows us to. So we docked at five ports during this voyage. The U.S. tried to threaten those countries and ask them not to allow the Iranian warships to dock there, but it didn't happen, and the U.S. should accept that the leverage that it shows, that it uses in the world, those levers are losing their power, are waning, and countries are trying to remain independent, and countries want to decide about their own future. You are seeing these developments in countries in the southern part of the Persian Gulf, and our flotilla, you saw that docked in those countries. U.S. threats are, in fact, threadbare threats. They are saying that they have just kept themselves alive by making these threats. They want to create the impression that they are the masters of the world, and the U.S. wants just to create the impression that it remains a master and a world power.
Let's get some analysis into this picture. Masoud Shajara is a political commentator joining us from London. We also have John Stepling, author and commentator, who joins us from Inderøy, Norway. Welcome to you both. Masoud Shajara, I'll first start with you. Regarding what has happened, I mean, this is a big deal for the Islamic Republic, but even not just for our country, but also in terms of the feat itself, it's something that can be marked as a great achievement because of the duration of time that took place. But given the circumstances behind the logistics of this and the pure material aspect of it, of which everything is indigenously made, making this trip, docking in different parts of the world, what kind of impression does that give you when it comes to Iran's achievement here?
Well, there are a number of points that are ticked by this event. One is the fact that international law of maritime, it's for everyone, and very often United States uses that by saying they've got the right to be just about anywhere in the world with their warships and so forth. Now, this is establishes that countries like Iran also have got those rights, and the United States cannot deny it. And the other aspect is that even to a non-expert like myself, it's very clear that Iran is a regional power. By this action, Iran is showing that they've gone beyond being regional power. They have got a presence, military presence now. They could have it anywhere else, and they're expanding that influence. I think also the challenging of the hegemony of United States by Iran is another factor which we need to recognize that is taking place, and the United States is not able to do anything about it whatsoever and is losing its influence. I think all these factors come together shows that the colonial power is losing its power internationally, not just in the region, but internationally.
All right, John Stepling, the flotilla actually docked on a number of ports around the world. I can mention the ones that were regionally somewhat, such as in India, in Mumbai, and then in Jakarta, and also the ones that went further out, which were Chile, Argentina, I'm reading down this list, Uruguay, and then Brazil. The reason why I'm mentioning this is that the U.S. Had an actual exerting pressure on these countries not to accept the flotilla docking at their ports. But they defied the U.S. demand, in a sense, and they allowed that to happen, especially the one about Brazil. That made a lot of news. Why do you think these countries, first of all, defied the U.S. Demand? And what does that show when that happens in turn?
Well, I mean, I think the story of the flotilla is really the decline of American power, the decline of American influence. It's just another, perhaps symbolic, but also perhaps a bit more than that, of the lack of U.S. control of not just the narrative, but look, they docked in Brazil. Brazil is a significant country. It's a BRICS country, number one, and it is a trade partner with the U.S. The U.S. has close relations with Brazil, and yet, Brazil ignored the U.S. pressure and allowed the Iranian ships to dock. What we're seeing globally right now, over the last, say, 5 years, has been this gradual but inexorable decline of influence in the U.S. And all the countries, which are several dozen countries that the U.S. sanctions, but primarily the big ones being Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, Syria, these, and now Russia, of course, these countries are doing fine. They're doing fine. Look at the conditions in the United States and look at the conditions in the countries sanctioned. One could argue that the United States domestically is in far deeper crisis economically, socially, in the mental health crisis. They have mass shootings every week. This stuff isn't happening anywhere else. Russia doesn't have children going around shooting each other in classrooms. Syria doesn't have that. None of these countries do. Venezuela doesn't have that. Only the United States. The U.S. has a crumbling infrastructure. I say this over and over, but it is deteriorating at an accelerating rate. So the decline in power and influence is having very tangible, real expressions out in the world now, and I think the de-dollarization is the sort of end game to all of this. It will take a number of years for that to finally have a decisive impact. But if you look ahead, and the U.S. leadership must know this, if you look ahead 20 years, the dollar may well be a junk currency by that point, because countries around the world, in the global south, the BRICS nations, are sick and tired of U.S. Supremacy, exceptionalism, what your other guest called a colonial mindset, and it's absolutely true. The U.S. has what? Who are their allies besides the EU and Israel? The U.S. has no significant allies anymore. Mostly the rest of the world hates them, and with good reason. And so here we have a sanctioned country, Iran, a very successful symbolic tour with this flotilla, and the U.S. could do nothing about it, had no effect whatsoever.
All right. Thank you very much for that. John Stepling, author and commentator. We appreciate your comments. Also, thank you, Masoud Shajara, political commentator from London. Thank you to you both. Moving on, at least six Iranian border guards have been killed in a terrorist attack in the southeast of the country. The incident took place in the Saravan region of Sistan and Balochistan province. Border guards engaged in armed clashes with terrorists trying to cross into Iran. The terrorists, however, were pushed back across the border after suffering deadly losses. Iran's Sistan and Balochistan province shares a long border with Pakistan and has seen several terrorist attacks targeting both civilians and security forces. Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound once again, further fueling anti-Israeli sentiments. The controversial move comes 3 days after the politician, along with tens of thousands of Israeli extremists, marched through the occupied Old City of Al-Quds and just over a week into a fragile Gaza ceasefire. With tensions flaring up in the occupied Palestinian territories, he has said that Israel is in charge of Al-Quds. Meanwhile, Hamas announced in a statement that the Israeli regime will be responsible for the consequences of the presence of Ben-Gvir and settlers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Of course, Monitor Ramallah Mona Kandil was earlier with us for the reactions to the controversial visit by the far-right Israeli minister to the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
This morning, Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, claiming that the Israeli authorities and the Israeli occupation will always be the masters of Al-Quds and the entire land of Israel, and that the complex there is owned by the Israelis. Immediately, a statement issued by the spokesman of the Palestinian Authority, Nabil Abu Rdena, calling on the raid by Ben-Gvir as a flagrant attack on Al-Aqsa, and he also warned that it would have serious repercussions. He said that the raid of Ben-Gvir, describing him as an extremist minister at the early hour like thieves into the Al-Aqsa Mosque Square, will impose, will not change reality and will not impose Israeli sovereignty there. The Foreign Ministry of Jordan also issued a statement condemning the raid of Ben-Gvir in the strongest terms, calling it a dangerous and unacceptable escalation. Hamas movement also issued a statement saying the Hamas movement will not leave Al-Aqsa alone, and warned that Israel will bear responsibility for the barbaric incursions of its ministers and herds of settlers.
On to Greece, polling stations have opened in a general election overshadowed by a cost of living crisis. The ruling New Democracy Party, headed by the Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis, is leading the opinion polls. However, a cost of living crisis and a train disaster in February have made it hard for the party to garner the needed votes. The left-wing Syriza party, chaired by the former premier Alexis Tsipras, is the main rival to the ruling party. Nearly 10 million people are eligible to vote. Meanwhile, changes to the electoral rules have reduced the party's chances to obtain the absolute majority. The party ranking first needs over 45% of the electorate to secure the majority in the 300-seat parliament. The U.S. president has announced yet another military aid package for Ukraine, which is worth up to $375 million. Joe Biden announced the aid in a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, on the sidelines of the G7 summit in Japan. Biden has told Zelensky that he is doing his utmost effort to strengthen Ukraine's defense systems. The latest aid includes ammunition, artillery, armored vehicles, and training. The U.S. and its Western allies have kept feeding Ukraine with massive amounts of arms since the start of the war last year. Moscow has time and again warned the military assistance would only prolong the war. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. This is bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023.
Students should not drown themselves in the internet. While the internet does exist in the country, despite all the things that are said here and there, social media exists and the internet exists. Some people sit around waiting to be flooded with analysis, news, and content from the internet. That's wrong. You need to seize control of the social media. You should be the ones to direct it. Your thoughts, news, and analysis should go out on the internet, not the other way around. These are things that plague student activities. Sometimes caring, faithful students ask us what their duty is. Sometimes they write to me. Or at times they come to our office and talk with our friends there. You can sense their concern and their willingness to do something. One of the important duties is to remove the impurities from important student activities, which are a great opportunity and something valuable for the country.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One more topic about students. I don't wish to answer your questions now with the things that I am saying. I mean, this is not what I'm trying to do now. I can't do this in this limited time. I want you to have a basis for your movement. In other words, organize your movement by looking at the long horizons ahead of you. You're seeking progress. The best youth in our country are mainly our university students. And you pious students want to move forward. I want this goal to be reached. Look at the distant horizon. They ask me, in your opinion, what is the duty of an ideal, ambitious student who is thinking about the future? This is my answer. The first thing is to bring about a change in the thinking and reality of your society, and then to bring about a change in the thinking and reality of the world. Does it surprise you that a student can change the reality of the world? It is not surprising at all. You are students today, but tomorrow, today's students will become directors in politics, and they will administer an important part of the country. The country's officials today used to be students like you, and now they are busy running the country's affairs. They are busy with managing the country's politics, economy, and diplomacy. Today's student is tomorrow's philosopher. He or she is tomorrow's researcher.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On September 9, 2001, a series of terror attacks targeted the United States. On that morning, a group of terrorists hijacked four commercial airliners. The hijackers crashed the first two planes into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York City. The third plane succeeded in crashing into the Pentagon, but the fourth one crashed in rural Pennsylvania. The U.S. regime used the incident to launch what it called the Global War on Terror.
They are obsessed with fueling conflict because they profit by the bloodshed, by the turmoil, by the tension, by the diplomatic unease. A lot of money is transferred into the bureaucracies of the military, the intelligence community, the diplomatic community, the military-industrial complex, the war profiteers who make bullets, bombs, tanks, helicopters, guns.
Washington first invaded Afghanistan and then attacked Iraq. A number of other countries were also affected by the wars.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed. 7,000 by the U.S. in the first month of the war, but now hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed by all parties over the 20 years, and that's in part because Iraq descended into civil war shortly after the U.S. invasion. And then, in addition, many millions of people were displaced. Millions of people are still displaced internally and also as refugees in the region.
The military aggressions were devastating for the affected countries and killed countless people. A new research by Brown University's Cost of War project has now shed light on the human cost of U.S. wars in the region. The report says America's war on terror in war zones of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen killed at least 4.5 to 4.6 million people, though the precise mortality figure remains unknown. The study reviews a wide range of factors contributing to mortality. Those include economic collapse and the resulting loss of livelihood for local residents, the destruction of health infrastructure and public services, environmental contamination, as well as other cultural effects of war that can lead to further violence down the line. Some of these people were killed in the fighting, but far more, especially children, have been killed by the reverberating effects of war, such as spread of disease. The report says these latter indirect deaths are estimated to be around 3.7 million. It says these deaths and related health problems have resulted from the destruction of economies, public services, and the environment in the affected countries. The report has also highlighted the fact that indirect deaths grow in scale over time. The researchers found staggering levels of child malnutrition in some of the affected countries, with Afghanistan and Yemen topping the list. In the wake of Washington's two-decade military occupation, more than 3 million Afghan children are now experiencing wasting, a symptom of severe and potentially life-threatening malnutrition. The U.S. officially ended its war in Afghanistan, but today Afghans are suffering and dying from war-related causes at higher rates than ever. Afghanistan's economy has collapsed, and over half of the population now lives in extreme poverty on less than $1.90 per day. More than 7.6 million children under 5 are suffering from acute malnutrition or wasting in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Somalia. Wasting means simply not getting enough food, literally wasting to skin and bones, putting these children at greater risk of death. Diseases such as measles and cholera often sicken malnourished people, particularly children, and at the same time worsen malnutrition.
And then what we also see is that even in the places where the fighting has stopped, civilians and other people, like healthcare workers, have been injured by unexploded ordnance, which has been left in the wake of the war. So the story continues. It's not over. It wasn't quick. It wasn't easy. And it certainly wasn't cost-free.
Hunger crises are precipitated by war's destruction of economies and the impoverishment of millions in the war zones. Poverty lessens people's abilities to grow and buy food, stay in their home communities, access clean water and sanitation, pay for healthcare and medicine, keep children away from hazardous jobs and other essential pathways to preserving health and life. Explosive remnants of war, including unexploded mines, render land inaccessible to farm and block the transport of goods. Generally, populations displaced by violence face some of the worst levels of food insecurity and malnutrition.
Iran and Russia have signed an agreement on the construction of the Rasht-Astara Railway, a strategic transport corridor that connects the existing railways of the two countries and Azerbaijan. The Iranian transport minister and his Russian counterpart, Vitaly Savelyev, put their signatures on the deal worth $1.6 billion during a ceremony in Tehran on Wednesday. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his Russian counterpart oversaw the event in person and via video link. The 162-kilometer railway will connect the Iranian city of Rasht near the Caspian Sea to Astara on the border with Azerbaijan. Upon completion, the railway would serve as a shorter and cheaper transit pathway for Asia and Europe's businesses. The development would also turn Iran into the region's trade crossroads and bring along stable and profuse revenues with the Islamic Republic. Including the part that crosses Iran, the passage serves to link Europe to the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean's littoral states, as well as the southeastern Asian countries. Transporting goods through the pathway takes 21 days. The alternative maritime route that travels across Europe's western and then southern flank before heading into the Red Sea, however, takes 45 days to complete and features an additional 30% expense.
This is a very important agreement that allows us to move to a new stage in the development of cooperation in the transport field. This is the largest infrastructure project that concerns the construction of a 162-kilometer section of the railway between the Iranian city of Astara and the city of Rasht. This is the section that is enough to completely close the railway communication through the territory of Russia, Azerbaijan, Iran, from St. Petersburg to the Persian Gulf and to Bandar Abbas. As soon as this project is implemented, then accordingly we will have a route and the possibility of deliveries both in transit to Europe and deliveries from Russia to the Persian Gulf. This is a huge market.
Separately, Iran and Russia are expanding their cooperation in the banking sector. Russia's second largest bank, VTB, has opened a branch in Iran. VTB is the first ever Russian bank to offer services in the Islamic Republic. Last December, VTB launched a service allowing both individuals and businesses to transfer money to and from Iran. Iranian companies will now have the chance to make international bank transfers. Moreover, VTB Bank and its subsidiaries are extensively active in South American countries, empowering Iran to diversify its exchange routes with export target countries in that region. Earlier this year, Governor of the Central Bank of Iran, Mohammad Reza Farzin, said a direct link had been established between the central banks of Iran and Russia. Iran and Russia have signed scores of economic and energy deals as the two countries seek to replicate their successful security and military cooperation in efforts that could offset the impacts of Western sanctions on their economies. Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak led a high-ranking delegation to major events and ceremonies. Novak met Iranian Oil Minister Javad Oji and also visited a number of oil and gas equipment manufacturers and discussed prospects for working together in the fuel and energy sectors. He said the oil and gas industry is a backbone for the economies of our countries. Strengthening bilateral cooperation in this area will undoubtedly increase the economic sustainability of Russia and Iran.
We are developing 8 of our oil and gas fields with strong Russian companies, and we have agreed with Mr. Novak for the development of 6 more fields.
The two sides also discussed cooperation in the field of electrical and nuclear energy, as well as renewable energy sources. Russia and Iran, both under Western sanctions, are forging closer ties in order to support their economies and to undermine Western sanctions, which they both cast as unjustified. Tehran and Moscow have embarked on deepening cooperation amid massive Western sanctions.
We are seeking specifically joint investments, facilitation of customs services and banking issues regarding the transfer of money between state banks and Mir Business Bank in Russia, which is of great help for Iranian businessmen.
Iran and Russia have signed major deals in recent months to boost economic, trade, energy and military cooperation. Russia is also delivering a complete squadron of Sukhoi Su-35 fighter jets to the Islamic Republic of Iran, development that will likely further rile up the West as Tehran and Moscow deepen their defense and economic cooperation in defiance of sweeping sanctions and coercive measures.
Turkey's presidential election is headed for a runoff vote. That's according to official results from the country's Supreme Election Council. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan took 49.5% of Sunday's vote, with his main challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu getting 44.89%. More than 64 million Turkish people, including overseas voters, were eligible to vote, and nearly 89% participated in the election to choose their next president and parliament for a 5-year term. As neither secured more than 50% of the vote, they will face off in a second round on May 28th. This is only the third time that Turks directly voted for a president, with Erdogan winning both previous elections outright in the first round. Polls and observers had predicted an advantage, if not an outright victory, for 74-year-old Kılıçdaroğlu. But as the final results from Sunday's election were announced, it became clear 69-year-old Erdogan had defied expectations, seizing a majority along with his nationalist coalition partners in parliament and forcing a second round vote in the presidential race. A voting observation mission by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe said political participation was high and voters had a choice between two political alternatives, but the incumbent president and the ruling parties enjoyed an unjustified advantage, including through biased media coverage. The polls were held against a background of a cost-of-living crisis that saw inflation peak at 85% in October, and earthquakes in February that killed more than 50,000 people in the country. These factors buoyed opposition hopes of unseating a leader known as Rais, or chief by supporters of the governing Justice and Development Party. Kılıçdaroğlu has promised to fix Turkey's faltering economy and restore democratic institutions compromised under Erdogan's rule. Erdogan, on the other hand, has been extolling the virtues of his long rule, campaigning on a platform of a stability, independent foreign policy, and continuing to bolster Turkey's defense industry. Recently, he raised the wage of government workers by 45% and lowered the retirement age. Taking place at the same time as the presidential race was the election of 600 parliamentary deputies. Although this was mostly lost amid the debate about Erdogan and Kılıçdaroğlu and whether either would gather more than 50% of the vote and thus avoid a second round. Turkey's election is widely considered to be the most important in the world this year, as a fight for the future of Turkish democracy and a possible shift in Turkey's influential role on the world stage. Parliamentary and presidential elections took place in Turkey on Sunday. In the 600-seat parliament, Erdogan's Justice and Development Party and its allies secured by far the most seats, 321, while the opposition won 213, and the 66 remaining seats went to a pro-Kurdish alliance. The elections are crucial to the future of Turkey's battered economy. Also, the vote had been presented as a last chance to stop Erdogan from turning the country into a full-blown autocracy. From 2003, Erdogan served three terms as prime minister. In 2014, when he was barred from running again, Erdogan stood for the largely ceremonial role of president. In 2016, he survived a coup, but that only strengthened his grip and consolidated his political standing in the country. A year later, he won a referendum that gave him sweeping presidential powers. While Erdogan's grip on the levers of power has brought Turkey close to autocracy, he has made serious economic missteps recently. He has increased his control of the theoretically independent central bank and steadfastly refused to increase interest rates despite soaring inflation. Turkish people are far poorer and more uncertain of their future as a result. The government response to the devastating recent earthquake was widely viewed as inadequate. In February, Erdogan made the tone-deaf comment that whatever happens, happens. This is part of fate's plan. However, he has outperformed expectations and appears to be further ahead than was previously predicted. Kılıçdaroğlu, a former accountant and bureaucrat and the longtime head of the Republican People's Party, was not a universally popular choice among the opposition to a stand. A social democrat, Kılıçdaroğlu is at the head of a coalition that includes nationalists who are only supporting him because of their desperation to unseat Erdogan. He has promised to stand down after a single term after instituting more conventional economic policies and restoring full parliamentary democracy. CHP leader Kılıçdaroğlu's six-party nation alliance has pledged to dismantle an executive presidential system narrowly voted in by a 2017 referendum. The opposition alliance also promised to restore the independence of the judiciary and the central bank and to reverse crackdowns on free speech and dissent under Erdogan. Turkey's elections have been billed as the most consequential since its first fair multi-party polls in 1950, boiling down to a choice between five more years of Erdogan, Turkey's most electorally successful politician, or a new direction under an old party that has reinvented itself in recent years.
Gaza Strip, and yet again, another Israeli deadly aggression on the blockaded territory that finally ended following an Egypt-brokered truce on Saturday. The five-day onslaught claimed the lives of over 30 people, including women and children. The Palestinian fatalities included several Islamic Jihad commanders. Khalil al-Bahtini, the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the northern Gaza Strip, Tariq Azzedine, a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, also managed retaliatory operations in the West Bank and Gaza, and Jihad al-Ghannam, secretary of the movement's military council, were all among those assassinated along with their families. A total of 51 Palestinian houses were completely destroyed, while about 1,000 others were damaged, prompting many people across Gaza to become homeless.
Now we are homeless, so we have no choice but to sleep on the street. Everything of us is ruined. I am worried about my children and other family members.
I demand compensation following this ceasefire because we are living on the streets now, no house or anything. My children and their children have no home. We are all left with nothing.
The conflict marked the worst episode of fighting between Gaza's resistance factions and the Israeli regime since the 10-day war in 2021. The carnage was to the extent which drew reaction from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza as unacceptable. The UN chief also called on the Israeli regime to immediately stop the bloodshed. Guterres said Israel must abide by its obligations under international humanitarian law, including proportionate use of force and taking all feasible precautions to spare civilians and civilian objects in the conduct of military operations. The UN chief also censured the Israeli closure of Gaza border crossings, which prevented the entry of foodstuff, medical supplies, and fuel into the besieged coastal territory. The latest Israeli aggression on Gaza brings to the spotlight the power and strength the Palestinian resistance groups have attained during the past several years. A joint statement by resistance factions in Gaza is a testimony to that. The statement said their retaliatory rocket attacks and the steadfastness of resistance fighters messed up the regime's calculations during the recent onslaught on Gaza. It added the new round of fighting with the occupying Israeli regime further strengthened the resistance front. The Zionist enemy mistakenly believed that the time was ripe for assassination of Palestinian resistance leaders, but it was a grave miscalculation. The umbrella group said that Israeli military officials had planned to wrap up the latest onslaught on the Gaza Strip in a very short span of time, but were stunned by the scope of resistance fighters' preparedness and rapid response to air raids. The groups warned Israel against the implementation of the policy of targeted killings, adding that resistance fighters have their fingers on the trigger and will not hesitate to respond in case the regime in Tel Aviv resorts to assassinations. But with Israeli officials admitting that the Islamic Jihad fired 6,000 rockets toward the occupied territories, it seems that the power of Palestinian resistance has already done the job, creating fear and threat among Israeli authorities. With all the fuss about the Israeli Iron Dome, numerous Palestinian rockets managed to intrude into the airspace of the occupied territories and inflict their stated losses. The death of an Israeli settler as a result of those rocket fires during the recent conflict was an indication of that. What seems to be of very high significance is that assassinating Palestinian commanders will not bring security to the Israeli regime and instead will enhance the extent of resistance on the part of Palestinian factions and increase their resolve in the face of the Israeli atrocities. That not only will cost Israel a heavy price in case of any gross miscalculations, as resistance leaders have put it, but will undoubtedly challenge the existence of an occupying regime.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamati. Islamati. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to your favorite program, That Is Youth Station. Once more, I have the honor to be here at your service, and here with me, I have Brother Habib.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome. Thank you guys for joining us. And of course, she said it's the best program. Not sure about that.
Thank you for reminding everyone of that. And yes, how are you doing?
Thank you. Good. And how have been things minimal to you nowadays?
Oh, minimal. You know, since I studied literature, I am very much interested in the minimalistic point of views in writing and in whatever that is related to literature. So in art, when we say minimalism, we actually mean simplicity and avoiding all the unnecessary things.
Like, for example, in Arabic, al-bala and balagha, we have this term ijaz. Right?
Yeah.
It's like to use as less words as possible.
To be laconic.
To have a lot of words, to have a lot of meanings in it.
Yeah.
What do you guys call that in linguistics, in the English language?
To be concise and laconic. Yeah.
Sometimes being minimal is good. I feel that it is.
Most of the time, I guess.
But as long as it gets your job done.
But, you know, in art, there's another point, there's another perspective to talk about it. When you use only one word in order to say all the meanings that you want to say, there might be some misunderstanding. Well, the same thing could not be applied in lifestyle. If you go for minimalism and lifestyle, there would be no misunderstanding. On the contrary, you would clarify everything for yourself and everybody around you.
Lifestyle, I don't know, but like, what are we talking about precisely when we say that lifestyle is minimal or not, and we're saying that it's bad or good?
Well, as in, if we want to define that, we would say that a minimal lifestyle is a lifestyle in which you're going to reduce the number of the things you have around you. Like, for example, if I want to make you have a picture of that, if I am the one who's practicing minimalistic lifestyle and you come to my home, then you're not going to see too much of chaos around me. Everything is just clarified. If I have, I don't know, one flower, there'd be only one basket of flower around me, not too many of them all around, or things just like that.
I don't know. I think that is good.
Of course.
Like only what you need you have, right?
Yeah.
There might be like to some extent where like the first aid kit, right, for medicine.
Yeah.
You don't need it now. You may never need a bandage from now till maybe a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
But you still keep that bandage with you.
Yeah.
Is that considered not minimal? I see it as minimal.
Of course it is, yeah.
It's the need. It goes back to the need.
I'm not sure that everybody would have the same idea about practicing a minimal lifestyle. You know, because to some people who has a very messy, you know, brain, it cannot be so easy to have a very simple lifestyle that has been organized in the way that you keep only the things that you need.
Now, look, sometimes you want to try things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Like, for example, having a swing in your house.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried that?
No.
I've tried it. It was fun.
Yeah.
For the first few hours. And then after that, it's not fun no more. And you just want to get rid of it.
And it becomes something extra in the house.
It becomes, you're like hoarding things now.
Exactly.
You start to hoard on to things. For example, I have a family member that likes to hoard plastic bottles, to reuse plastic bottles.
Oh, wow.
So he just keeps them.
So considerate, right? Of them.
He doesn't use them. If he uses them, it will be considered, yeah, you know, like minimal. Because he's using them, for example,
keep
for a pot.
Keep them for the rainy days.
Yeah, for projects, for whatever.
Yeah.
But he's not using them in that manner. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, nowadays, are we living minimal lives or not? I mean, this question just popped up to my mind.
Well,
like smartphones,
yeah.
Are smartphones minimal?
It's a very good question. But I guess before we get into it, we'd have to go for a short break and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Yes, this is Youth Station, and you're still listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about minimal lifestyle, and then Brother Habib said that, are we practicing minimal lifestyle nowadays? And I have to say, economically speaking, we are forced to practice minimalistic point of view as in lifestyle.
Maybe not. I don't know why the economy could be just like a blockade. But before that, I want to ask, like, are the things that we have nowadays, are they considered minimal or not? Like, we have smartphones. Can we live without smartphones?
Yeah, can we live without them? No, I guess. No, we can't. Half so of the things we do are done with these small phones, so...
I still to this day know people who don't have smartphones.
Maybe they're living in a far-off corners
the
guy's world.
The guy's a lawyer.
He's a lawyer. Very nice. Like,
he's a lawyer. He doesn't have a smartphone.
So how is he going to connect with his...
He has the old Nokia phones.
Mm-hmm. You know, the still, he's got tabuge. A cell phone.
Yeah, it's called tabuge in Iraqi. He has that phone. It works. Mm-hmm. He sends messages with it. He calls people. He's living with the social media.
So still, he's using a cell phone.
Not a smartphone. I mean, like nowadays, if I was walking the other day in the United States, I was just looking at people. All their heads were on their phones.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone had an iPhone. Everyone had a Samsung.
Yeah.
There was nothing in between.
Because it has been a part of our life, you know. Many people are working with their cell phones. It's not just a matter of entertainment.
But is it a minimal or not? Is it a minimal or not? I had an example that I brought up.
Yeah.
You could say we could live without it.
Yes, I guess it is minimal because, you know, everything has been collected in one small little thing that you carry with yourself everywhere you go.
Maybe it's because your lifestyle maybe brings it up.
Maybe.
So your lifestyle is the one that portrays whether this thing is minimal or not.
Yeah.
So therefore, every person depends from situation to situation. Again, this brings up the concept of zakat, for example.
And what is zakat?
Zakat, of course, almsgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 8 specific places where you could give your zakat. One of them being a poor person. So a man comes to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and asks him. He tells him that this person that I want to give zakat to, he has 2 houses. He has servants. He has this and that. Yet, he is considered to be the sheikh, the leader, the chief.
The one who
of his tribe, right? And you know the chief, you know the word of, you've heard the word diwan, right?
Yeah.
You know, the meaning of diwan, like it's that place where they sit down, where the entire family comes, people from outside the tribe come and sit down with the tribe
like
leader.
Like the gatherings
chief.
Are held there.
He needs servants. Mm-hmm. He needs food. He always has people coming over, so he always has to have food. So, can I give the zakat to this person? Imam tells him that if this person needs this, it is his lifestyle, yes, give it to him.
Yeah.
So, therefore, every person, every human being's lifestyle, every person's own situation is what considers whether this person is living the minimal life or not. You could have, for example, a car. It could be minimal for you. Because you could have 2 cars, 3 cars. For me, I don't need a car. So the minimum for me is not having a car.
Yeah.
So it depends from every person to every person.
I get your meaning, but still, living minimal life, I guess, is the same for every single person. When we say minimal, I get what you're saying. You mean that it depends on your situation, on your own lifestyle, and your whatever, who you are. It depends. But still, when we say minimal life, all that we mean to say is to live a simple life. Like, for example, if you have 2 cars,
all right.
If you have 2 cars, you can sell one and spend the money on your neighbor who doesn't have enough of facilities, or on the person in your family, not very much far a family, who's in need of money. You can share your car with that person. So that would be also considered the alm that you were talking about. It could be considered the same way.
Yeah, so we're not disagreeing on this.
Yeah.
No,
I'm just saying that when we say minimal, we do not mean that you should have 3 cars or whatever. All we mean to say is that 1 car is going to do the thing that 3 cars are going to do for you. I guess the whole idea behind this minimal lifestyle is to give away the extra things.
So yeah, to keep away the extra things that are out of your need.
Yeah.
Everyone has their own situation.
Yes.
You don't need bookshelves. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you don't have books. I need bookshelves. So every person has their own situation.
Yeah.
And therefore, there could be needs that I have that you don't have, that I need that you don't need.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the minimum for me is going to be closing this need, and the minimum for you is going to be something else. Yes. So therefore, it's relative.
Of course. So, and just right like this, we get to go for a break. Yes, we're talking about minimal lifestyle. A minimalist lifestyle is the process of identifying what is essential in your life and having the courage to eliminate the rest.
Now, of course, look, sometimes living minimal doesn't always mean that you're going to be saving money. Do you agree on that?
It depends.
Because sometimes when you buy something, it doesn't count, it doesn't matter the quantity, but rather the quality of what you buy.
Yeah.
So, for example, I could buy a wooden bookshelf. I could buy the steel bookshelves.
Mm-hmm.
The wooden ones are much more luxurious, you could say.
Yeah.
They last less than the steel ones. And the steel ones last longer and are easier to put and are a lot cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
So, I might spend more. Because I need to have a good looking bookshelf. Because when people come over or for filming sake or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it also depends. It could be expensive for me to live a minimal life.
Yeah. Now I ask you a question. Now put all of these things aside and think about the idea behind practicing this lifestyle. What do you think are the reasons for that? I mean, why this lifestyle has been considered as a trend right now?
Is it a trend?
Yeah, it has been so trendy and many people are going for that. If you go for interior designs, you could see that there is this attraction to this sort of lifestyle or to this sort of design, interior designs. So why they do that? The idea behind that, according to you, what is the first thing that will come to your mind?
The first thing that really comes to my mind actually is because I feel like I'm living a minimal life. Mm-hmm. I don't buy anything that I don't need.
So that's first perfect. Of all.
The reason why I don't do it is because I see myself that I don't need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only reason I see it. It's not just because of an economical problem that I have. Some other families might see, it's because of an economical problem. Some other people, because it's the trend. I want to be in the trend. Mm-hmm. Some other people, because, you know, it feels good. It feels good. I know people who live in some countries that they have to move from house to house. They're renting. You have to move from house to house every year. Therefore, if you have a lot of property, then it's going to be troublesome when you're moving.
Exactly.
So therefore, they live a minimal
traveling.
Lifestyle.
A person who wants to travel for packing a suitcase, they would pack it so light because they're traveling all the time. So the same thing could be applied for those people who are practicing minimalistic lifestyle. And I guess the idea behind that is just to make you focus on the important things instead of, making a mess in your brain so that you have to think about every single detail that is existing in a corner of your house.
That's nice. Like you're saying, like, they'll be stress-free.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. That is
true. To free up your mind.
Really, really. Just like when you don't own like the things that you don't need,
mm-hmm.
you're just stress-free about them. You only have what you need and only use what you need. And really just fewer distractions. That's
exactly.
What it is. It really is fewer distractions.
That's the idea, That's the point. It's to reduce the amount of distraction that your brain is going to suffer from. Because in that way, you're going to focus on the more important things. And the whole idea behind minimalistic lifestyle is that. And of course, in art also, when we talk about minimalistic style of writing or of painting or of anything else is to focus on a certain point that you want to say. That's why you're not going to use too much of words and you're not going to make it so messy. And that was all that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you.
everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.